Welcome to the DFA podcast. On today's episode, we talk about Reese Hoskins, Blake Wood, and we name drop our favorite managers. Keep it here. It's the DFA podcast.
Welcome to episode 26 of the DFA podcast. I'm your host, Brian Grosnick, and joining me is RJ Anderson of CBS Sports. RJ, how's it going on this fine Monday morning?
It's going well. How's it going for you, Mr. Brian?
It's going all right. I'm kind of getting excited for the end of the season. I mean, we're about to hit our September call-ups. We're about to hit, you know, some of the most exciting moments of this garbage fire of an AL wildcard race. We actually got some stuff to look forward to this September, I feel like.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy in the American League and even the National League. While there's not a whole lot of drama, it's getting a little tighter, and you never know, a whole month of baseball to go, plus whatever left this week, and we'll see. But I think we have some transactions to talk about too, which is kind of the reason d'etre for this podcast, right?
It is our excuse for talking about baseball. It really is. So we're going to talk about a transaction that is relevant today, but it's not a transaction that was made this week. It's actually what we had considered a relatively minor transaction and didn't give it a lot of time on the show previously, but it's turned out to be something that is much more newsworthy than we might have expected at first. The transaction that I'm talking about is the Phillies calling up Reese Hoskins to be the new everyday first baseman. And the reason why it's our big move for this episode is because Reese Hoskins apparently is going full, I don't know, it's either Barry Bonds or Kevin Moss. And it's kind of hard to figure out which way it is right now. But Hoskins has been incredible since he's been called up. He's been hitting dingers left and right. And I think it's important that we talk about, you know, what his performance means, what he's doing, and what level of regression we should expect going forward, because I don't think anybody expects that he's going to be the kind of player that hits, 100, 105 home runs in a season, right?
I mean, you know, there's a chance, but yeah, I guess I would say the most interesting thing to me so far is that this is another instance where a right-on-right corner infielder has kind of been overlooked. And You know, if you think about it, there's a tendency to underrate that profile, because I think we've talked about him before, but Trey Mancini, he's been very good for the Baltimore Orioles. I think this season he's hitting like OPS around like 860 at this point. And you know, nobody really talks about him because he doesn't walk, but also because, you know, it seems like we've made a habit out of ignoring him. And in Hoskins' case, obviously the performance has been more extreme. But again, he's a right-on-right corner infielder, and we've seen this type play much better than the prospect list suggests, whether it's Paul Goldschmidt, even Mark Trumbo for a while there was much better than his prospect pedigree had suggested. So I think Hoskins is an interesting case. Obviously, I don't think, you know, this level of performance is sustainable, but do you think it's possible we underrated him just because he bats right-handed and plays first base?
Yeah, I definitely think his profile makes a difference in why he was underrated. At the same time, you know, you have to have such a level of positive performance in terms of your offense to really be much of a prospect as a first baseman. You just have to be so much better than your average hitter. I think part of the issue with Hoskins is something that I've seen talked about on Twitter a little bit, and that's Hoskins showing a dramatic ability to make adjustments up to this point in his minor league and now major league career. And he kind of represents what has been, from a player development and from a kind of a scouting perspective, a best case scenario. A lot of people were saying that Hoskins had the power to succeed at the major league level, that he could hit, but it was a matter of whether or not at each level that he got to, would he kind of rise to the challenge? Would he make the adjustments to hit off speed stuff? Will he really drive and continue to drive the pitches that he does see to hit? So I think that, you know, as much as hitting is a game of adjustments and eventually pitchers are going to adjust back to Hoskins, I think maybe what was underrated about him the most was his ability to adapt to each new level that he was presented with. Now, of course, that's going to be underrated because it's a really hard thing to measure. I mean, you're not going to be able to have scouts come out and say, oh, yeah, this guy's going to adapt really well, because that's a tough thing to measure. But he has made his tools play up. So I think that's kind of what we would want to see in a player. He just seems to be living his kind of his best case scenario right now, rather than just being like a Chris Bryant type where the expectation was already so high for him that, you know, any adjustments they made would kind of be icing on the cake, rather than what would transform him from being an okay player to an above average regular.
That makes sense. And the other interesting thing to me is his approach. If you look at his play discipline numbers, he's been very patient at the plate. He's swinging less than 40% of the time, not expanding his zone. He doesn't really swing and miss as much as you would expect someone with this kind of power production to swing and miss. I think it's at like 15%. So, you know, he's making contact like 85% of the time while hitting all these dingers. That's a pretty good sign. Yeah, and what you said about, you know, having to make adjustments, that's obviously valid. And, you know, that separates some of the better hitters from some of the not so good hitters, because, you know, it seems like everyone has a stretch where they can go on a hot streak. It's a matter of how they maintain or how they level off when they chill off a little bit. So, yeah, we're going to see what Hoskins does. And obviously it's only like a dozen games at this point, so maybe it's just the best dozen games of his life, but this has been a very impressive performance. And if you buy into signature significance or whatever, the Bill James theory that, you know, you perform so well over a limited stretch that tells you all you need to know, even if it is in a small sample, then maybe we have underrated him, and maybe he's much better at the whole making adjustments, or at minimum succeeding without making those adjustments thing than we anticipated.
Yeah, and I think the other side of citing Bill James here is probably citing Voris McCracken's law, which is Voris's law is that anything can happen in 70 plate appearances,
sure.
And Hoskins has 72 right now. So I think there's a little bit on both sides there. The other thing about Hoskins is that he's a kind of like, right now at least, he's kind of a poster boy for scouting the stat line, which is something we're not supposed to do for minor league players. His minor league statistics have always outstripped his scouting profile. They've pretty much consistently in Double A and Triple A over the last couple of years, he's been murder on opposing pitchers. I just kind of feel like with what we've seen from Aaron Judge and what we've seen for other young players who come up to the majors, even the best young players who come up have to make some sort of adjustments when pitchers start adjusting back to them. And so I don't think anybody's questioning that there's going to be a great deal of regression, because, you know, nobody hits for an 800 plus slugging percentage forever unless they're Barry Bonds. And I just have a feeling that his ability to adapt that he's shown up to this point probably bodes well for him in the future. But at the same time, you wouldn't be all that surprised to see him go through a second half Aaron Judge type stretch where all of a sudden he's, you know, swinging and missing more, he's being more aggressive, and it's not paying off for him. So given what you know about Hoskins, given what you've seen from him up to this point, and given your wealth of knowledge about baseball, would you try to peg him for a certain amount of power or a certain amount of production going forward, or do you think at this point it's just too much of an open question?
Well, that's a good question. I guess the name that popped to mind for me was not Aaron Judge, but Eric Thames.
Yeah.
Because he homered 11 times in his first 24 games this season, had a pretty good walk-to-strikeout ratio. I think he even was hitting like 345, and then obviously the performances tailed off a little bit. I don't know if I'd make too big of an adjustment from what the scouting reports expected, which is, I believe, like 5 hit and 6 power or somewhere around that range. Because, you know, it is 11 games, it is 12 games, what have you. But I don't know, man. I think I'm going to stick with that for the most part. I'm not sure I believe that he is significantly better, but it wouldn't surprise me either if he's actually like a half to a full grade better in a year's time or what have you. But I don't know. I'm just so hesitant to be like, I don't want to be like the first one to, you know, pump him up and just for the sake of being the first one to pump him up. You know what I mean? I'd rather be a little late in this case than be a little early and a little wrong. I don't know. What about you? Would you be more aggressive on setting a higher expectation now that he's performed so well over 11 games?
No, not really. I think some of it has to do with the strength of his opponents, opposing pitchers that he's hit these dingers off of. I believe a lot of them were on the Padres, which is like that doesn't really count. And so it's kind of similar to the way Thames really like owned the Reds at the beginning of the season. I mean, so many of his homers came against a Reds pitching staff that was horrible. And so I definitely think that's a wonderful comparison. I really like that. Before the season, Pecota had projected him to be about a win above a replacement, and hit, for a 277 true average, which both of those things sound right to me still. Like, it still seems like he's probably, at least at this point in his career, something more akin to a good hitting first baseman, something more like a Lucas Duda type hitter. Rather than, a world-class Mike Trout type hitter. So I would kind of peg him for finishing out the season maybe with two, maybe even three wins, but I just don't see him continuing to hit homers at such a vicious rate, even playing in Philadelphia, even against bad pitching. He's going to have a great finish to the season, I'll bet, but I think in 2018 you're going to see something that's a lot more along the lines of a league average first baseman.
That makes sense. And I said 11 games. It's actually 18 games. I was getting the home run total in my head. So, yeah, I'm interested to see what he does. I'm interested to see if he continues to play left field for them. Do you think he's possibly a solution in left field, or do you think he's going to end up at first base heading into next season?
Well, I really think that first base is the right place for him. I mean, if you look at some of the other guys that they've got on the come up in Philadelphia, you've got guys like Dylan Cousins, and you've got other players who could possibly play first base, and they still have Tommy Joseph. But Tommy Joseph, I think at this point they have more holes in the outfield with some of the guys that they've got injured or some of the guys that they've been missing this season, but I really don't see him staying in the outfield in the long term. I think the Phillies will probably make some moves to try to move some guys around and, give the young players that they've got like Altair and Nick Williams and maybe get a veteran guy in to play the outfield. And I think Hoskins is more of that first base option.
But, while we're talking about dingers, there's another guy in the National League East who's hitting a lot of home runs lately, the Giancarlo Stanton. He's on pace for what, 75 home runs? I don't know. Who cares at this point? It seems like he's going to hit a home run every day. I mean, Hoskins' performance is probably being overshadowed a little bit because Stanton has been so good. And there was a point last week where I was doing a radio interview and I looked at his second half splits and he'd almost averaged an extra base hit per game in the second half. And that is insane to me to almost average one extra base hit per game when you've played, it's been what, a month plus since the All-Star break. So what do you think about Stanton's season, Stanton's chances of topping not only 60 home runs, but can he get higher?
Well, I mean, at this point, I would really be skeptical of trying to give him more than 60 home runs because, we've seen so many times in the past that these runs of, just unbelievable home run hitting excellence, they don't seem to last forever. They don't carry on at this pace that he's been hitting them at for extended periods of time, unless you're talking about these really, epic home run seasons like the Maguire and Bonds type seasons. And yeah, he's got that kind of physical strength to be like one of those guys, but he's never been on a tear like this for such an extended period before. It seems unfair to assume that he's going to continue. On the other hand, he is not the kind of guy who's going to be really kind of boxed in by his opposing pitcher or his opposing stadium, where he's going to go, what, back to Miami and he's just not going to hit balls out of the park anymore. If he gets a hold of something, it's going out of whatever park he plays in. So the on-pace numbers make me a little bit nervous just because whenever something is not normal, I expect things to go back to normal. But, September, you got September call-up pitchers, you've got a lower level of competition. Offense seems to go up a little bit in September. I don't know. It's definitely in play. He's never going to get to 70, I think, but 60 is certainly in play. I just don't know how much more than 60 he's going to get.
Yeah, I agree with that. And just to recite some of his numbers here, in August alone, he's played in 25 games and he has 23 extra base hits, including 17 home runs. In the second half as a whole, in 41 games, 34 extra base hits, including 24 home runs. That's insane. And, I agree that I don't think he's going to top more than 60. And I agree that I don't know how long this is going to last, but it's really nice to finally have a Stanton season where I guess it kind of lives up to the hype, because we've been expecting this guy to post, 50 plus home runs basically since the day he walked onto a big league field.
Mm-hmm.
And all it seems like there's injuries that pop up. And to his credit, he's, stayed healthy this season. And here we go. He's threatening 60 home runs. This is exactly what we always expected out of him. And it's nice to finally have that happen, because I don't know. He's turned 28 in November. I guess I was starting to wonder, are we ever going to see one of these banana seasons from him? Or is this going to be a case where we look back and say, man, why didn't he ever have an Aaron Judge-like stretch? And or a Reese Hoskins-like stretch.
Right.
Here we are. He is having one of these historic stretches that, we're going to look fondly upon in 10, 15, 20 years. And that's pretty great, because, again, I was starting to wonder, And I would just note that I don't think it's likely that they're going to make the postseason, but Miami is over 500 now, and they entered today 4.5 games out of the wild card spot. That's really impressive for a team that, had a lot going against it.
So, yeah, I definitely think that the Marlins being better than expected at the end of the season has been a complete shock. While I do think that they're going to keep it interesting, I don't see them catching one of the other teams because their starting rotation is so terrible. And, I mean, even some of their regulars in the infield, they're missing Justin Bour, they're missing Martin Prado. They trade away Danny Hecheverria, which was probably addition by subtraction, but it's still not, they probably like another hand on deck, probably. It's shocking to see the Marlins play this well. And yes, the National League East and their competition there has been very, very bad. So I think that obviously makes a big difference. Taking it back to Giancarlo for a minute, I don't want to spoil an article that I'm working on, but it's kind of, you mentioned like, oh, now he's finally breaking out. This is finally the season that we wanted him to have. And I kind of want to push back against that narrative a little bit.
Right.
Because in terms of home runs, he's always been expected to be this 40, 50, almost 60 home run monster. And that's perfectly acceptable. And so this season, he's finally doing that, because up until this year, the most homers he'd ever have in a season was like 37.
It was 37, yeah. I mean, it's because of health, right? Because that was the last time he topped 600 plate appearances. It looks like he's going to do it this year. This will be his third time total, and this is his eighth year. So it seems like injuries pop up every year and limit him to, 500 or fewer plate appearances.
And in that age 25 season that he had back in 2015, he had 27 homers in just 318 plate appearances, 74 games.
Yeah.
So it's not like he hasn't flashed this before. But what I want to talk about for a second is, you just mentioned this is his eighth year in the league. That's crazy. Like, he's been around for eight seasons, and if you look back at his numbers over the past eight seasons, we are talking about a no-doubt Hall of Famer if he continues anywhere close to this trajectory, because if you look at his Baseball Prospectus wins above replacement, even though he hasn't lived up to his potential, what people say about him, he's got a career .330 true average. He's already got over 40 wins above replacement player by BP's metric, and he's in his age 27 season.
Yeah,
I mean, this is supposed to be his peak, and maybe he is peaking. Maybe he's going to have a swift decline, but we're going to very quickly see him move up into the 40, 50, 60 win range, which is right that kind of borderline for a Hall of Fame player. And part of the reason for that is because he's a transcendent offensive player. But the secret reason behind it is that his defense is really good, and he's continuing to get credit for it in the advanced metrics. And as far as right fielders go, you can't do much better than Giancarlo Stanton defensively. And I think that's kind of a secret part of his value that he brings to these teams. And I do definitely think that he's kind of been underrated up until this season because of the injuries and because he hasn't hit for quite as much power as we imagined. But he's like a legitimate all-world caliber outfielder. And I think he's finally getting some due for it.
Yeah, and just to add on to your point about the Hall of Fame aspect, looking at his Baseball Reference page, he's got a 34 career WAR, 31.5 7-year peak. And if you look at Jaws, the average right fielder has 73 WAR and a 43 7-year peak. And just confirming, yep, those numbers do account for this season. So, he's definitely getting closer to having a case. Like you said, he has to continue. And I guess my reservations about saying, oh, he's going to continue is tied to the health aspect. I don't know. I'm just naturally more conservative about players who have shown an inability to stay healthy than others are, especially when it comes to pitchers. I mean, you know, we talked about Brett Anderson, and I've been all out on that guy for years, because once you miss, you know, most of two or three seasons, I start getting very, very, very hesitant that you're ever going to be able to stay healthy. And that's not to say, you know, that they can't. Obviously, Anderson even had that one healthy season. It's just I start to kind of lower the likelihood of that in my mind. And with Stanton, I might be lowering it too much. Maybe he figured out the secret to staying healthy. Maybe his injuries were just freak accidents. I don't know. We used to say that about Mark Pryor, too, that all of his injuries are kind of freak accidents. So you know what? Eventually, he'll be healthy. Didn't really happen there, but you know, I don't know what's worse, getting hurt on a freak accident over and over again, or getting hurt because you ran hard to first base and you pulled a hamstring. So I don't know the answer to that. I'd be curious if anyone can figure out the answer to that, because that would be a, you know, that'd be a pretty interesting study, and be pretty interesting about what it tells you about the human body, and especially ball players' bodies. But the point is, I would be hesitant to say Stanton is heading to the Hall of Fame, largely because of his health rather than his talent or production level.
Yeah, I think that's very fair. I think we do need to be realistic about that. You know, with his athleticism, you would think that he would be able to maintain some level of performance going into his 30s, but with the injuries, that kind of maybe negates that. So it's, yeah, it's definitely an open question. I just feel like it's important to recognize that amidst this, you know, incredible, what we consider a breakout season, that Stanton was pretty good to begin with. And, you know, for a guy with, what, 950 career games, he's already got, you know, some of the best offensive numbers of his generation, and he's already been doing quite a bit defensively to back that up. So it's maybe just an appropriate coming out party rather than just something that should be surprising folks at this point.
Yeah, and I would just say, you know, the counting numbers are the thing when it comes to home runs. And even if he's had an impressive home run slash plate appearance ratio or home run slash game ratio, ultimately, you know, those guys get judged on the big round number at the bottom of the page. And he's at 258. If we agree that he's going to get the 60, you know, he could be threatening 300 fairly early next season. And from there, I mean, he's going to shoot up the chart if he can stay healthy. So it'll be interesting to see what number he finishes with, because if you had to guess right now, he's going to top 500, right?
Yeah, I think so, because if you think about it just on the on pace, you know, going back to that, if he does eight more seasons, and they'll be his age 28 through, what, 36 seasons or 35 seasons, 250 home runs does not seem out of the question, even if he has minimal performance because of injury, because that's what he did in his first eight seasons. So I kind of feel like that 500 is certainly in play. And if he gets to 500, given his era, then that's probably even more impressive than guys like Rafael Palmeiro, who hit 500 in and also had, you know, some of, maybe you'd say, some of the similar issues about having being a very good defensive player, but not an exceptional defensive player and playing on bad teams. But you account for the era, and all of a sudden Stanton's 500 homers look a bit more impressive than somebody like Palmeiro's.
Yeah, that makes sense. Anyway,
that's a nice little run on dingers. And now, having talked about it, maybe both these guys' bats will go quiet for the rest of September, and we'll look a little silly for talking about it. But I think it's been fun watching him hit, and it's injected a little life into the National League East, and we could certainly use that.
Oh, I absolutely think they're both going to go silent now, and we will look very silly, but no more silly than usual when we're typically joined by Mr. Sean Brody. Unfortunately, he is not with us today. He is on Cambodia. So we're going to move on to our batting practice segment. See, that's why we need Brody, because I can't even say batting practice without stumbling over it. And our first small move of the day was a move that involved someone who was almost a World Series hero last season. The Boston Red Sox traded Rafael Rincones for Rajah Davis. So how does Rajah Davis fit into the Red Sox outfield depth chart?
Well, I wrote this up for Baseball Prospectus, as I want to do. I do think he has been added to the team as kind of a replacement for Jackie Bradley Jr., but that's miscasting him. He's not a good defensive center fielder. I even made a very small joke at his expense about that at Sabre Seminar, when I had a picture of a bad defensive center fielder who was also very fast, and how you could use that to improve his performance. And I used a picture of Rajah Davis with his face cut out. So, yeah, he's a fast guy, but he's not a good defender in center field, whereas Jackie Bradley Jr. is not that fast, but he's an exceptional defender in center field. And Bradley hits left and Davis hits right, so he's not a good replacement for Jackie Bradley Jr. However, he's a really good fourth or fifth outfielder for this Red Sox team. They don't have a lot of dedicated speed on their bench. He can play center field, even though he probably shouldn't. He's better cast as a corner outfielder. So he fits really well on this roster. He's a good acquisition. They didn't give up too much to get him. Just don't try to make him be Jackie Bradley Jr. because he's not.
Yeah, and he's not a very good hitter whatsoever. Mm-hmm. I agree with your point about the speed off the bench, and I agree that he's not a good defender because of his routes and whatnot. I like him as a pinch runner type addition as well. You know, he's been a good volume thief over his career, 80%. He's going to steal 30 bases this year, barring, you know, something weird happening. So I like that, and I probably overrate that when it comes, you know, October. But I really like adding a designated pinch runner type. And I know, you know, the value can vary based on your team, but if you're going to get one, you know, get one of the best base stealers in baseball or what have you. And I think he qualifies or has qualified in recent seasons. So, yeah, I like that. And, you know, they gave up a teenager who wasn't in MLB.com's top 30 for them. So this is a likable addition, even if Davis isn't Bradley Jr. and isn't a starting caliber outfielder anymore.
Right. And then the most important part of this acquisition is that it does open up a roster spot in Oakland so that they could call up Mark Canna and put him back in the outfield. So I'm still hanging on to that dream.
It all goes back to Mark Canna. Wasn't that our first or second episode when we went off the mark?
I think it was. It was definitely at least one of the first two. But yeah, my irrational love for Mark Canna continues. And so hopefully he'll get another shot this September to prove he's a reasonable baseball player.
Speaking of irrational love of things that Brian has, it's Mets time.
This week, there's no love here.
Fair. This week, the Mets placed two outfielders on the disabled list. Yoenis Cespedes went on with a right hamstring strain, and he may miss the rest of the season. Meanwhile, Michael Conforto suffered a possible – actually, it was a tear of his posterior capsule on his left shoulder and is out for the rest of the year. Brian, I'm just going to give you the floor on this one and let me know when you're ready to move on. But by all means, then away.
I'm ready to move on from this Mets team in general. Cespedes getting injured, pulling his hamstring, not surprising. He's going to have continued leg issues for his entire career, I think, just because of the way he's built. So this doesn't break my heart. This is something that you kind of come to expect with Cespedes. And, you know, before his injury, he was hitting really well. He's been hitting as well as he ever has as a Met. And when he comes back from his leg injury, he'll probably hit really well because that's what he does. He's got this level of performance that's kind of a baseline now that we expect. Conforto is heartbreaking. Conforto is awful because, first of all, he has a much more serious injury because tearing your capsule in your shoulder and possibly there was some dislocation there. That's not the sort of injury that you can just pop back out from and say, oh, yeah, everything's fine. You know, he may recover fine, he may not. But he's also a lot younger. He's also kind of been this cornerstone, this bright spot of the season for the Mets this year. Everybody on the Mets seems to get injured, and we can't stop it. And so it's really depressing. And if, God forbid, you know, he's injured enough so that he's not at full strength for the start of next season, or he's diminished in some way next season, or he doesn't even make it back to the team until May or June, which is certainly not out of the question given the Mets training staff. The 2018 Mets are probably, maybe, possibly the last call for this kind of team that was good enough to get to the 2015 World Series and make two playoff appearances, because you're starting to have pitchers get more expensive. These injuries are kind of piling up. The team doesn't seem willing to put a lot of money towards it. So 2018 is kind of like the year for this Mets team. And if they can't get off to a good start and Conforto's not there, then you have to have a little concern that maybe it's going to be time to really burn it down as opposed to the Mets, you know, junior sell-off that they had this offseason. So that's it. That's all
I
got.
Is that all? Are you sure?
Yeah. I mean, you have any thoughts on these two guys at all, RJ?
No, I think pretty much what you said. It's not too surprising the Cespedes got hurt, but it is heartbreaking that Conforto was hurt. He looked like a young star in the making, and I just hate the idea that, you know, maybe he comes back and he's not quite what he was, and then we're kind of in a similar situation to David Wright. And I guess does it summon some of those old demons that surrounded Jose Reyes and David Wright when they were young and all of a sudden they start going through these injury issues. You know, do you get that feel at all? Is it a little bit of deja vu, or am I just trying too hard to rile you up on this Monday morning?
I don't think so, because Reyes was the same kind of exciting young player. I mean, obviously not the same kind of exciting young player, but he was the guy who had the injury issues, and he was the guy who was the more exciting of the two. I mean, when I was a Mets fan in the early aughts, I was more into Jose Reyes than I was David Wright, because he was so much fun to watch. And Conforto's kind of more along the lines of that player. His hitting is so interesting and exciting to watch. You know, he's kind of the guy that draws your eye. I mean, now that Rosario's up, Ahmed Rosario might be that guy going forward, but he was kind of like the exciting young player, whereas Wright was a little bit more traditionally good as a baseball player. So, whenever it's the exciting young guy, it always hurts a little bit more. But
that makes sense.
I don't know. Maybe we should try a transaction that goes the other way, where I kind of cede the floor to you and let you vent a little bit. So I'd like to talk about the Rays' recent acquisition of Danny Espinosa and kind of see what your thoughts are on this move.
Yeah, it makes no sense. they traded a guy in Tim Beckham, who, by the way, the Baltimore Orioles are having Tim Beckham T-shirt day next week. So just let that one set in for a minute. And meanwhile, the Rays are signing Danny Espinosa, who is on his third team of the season. He's been awful for a while now. And I think we talked about him when he was signed by the Mariners and how he'd been really bad in recent years. And I don't know, man. Like, when they made the Tim Beckham trade, the rationale from some people was that, hey, they have a ton of infield depth. They have Daniel Robertson coming back from the disabled list. They have Willy Adames on the verge of being promoted to the majors. And I didn't buy any of that, because they promoted Taylor Featherston. And I was like, yeah, if you're going to use those other players as reason the Rays can't carry Tim Beckham, then, you know, I think you're lost in the woods, because they were depending on Peter Borges and Trevor Plouffe as their right-handed pop against lefties, and hey, that hasn't gone too well. Plouffe has been designated for assignment, and they brought up they claimed Cesar Puolo off waivers, which just goes to show you that they are desperate for right-handed help. And yeah, it just makes no sense at all. I don't understand what they're doing. I know Mark Topkin, the Tampa Bay Times beat writer for the Rays, floated the idea that they might be trying to game Robertson's service time. And let me just tell you, I don't know what's worse, the idea that you would game Daniel Robertson's service time, or the idea that you would, like, be so bold about it. Because with due respect to Daniel Robertson, if you haven't been paying attention to his season, in 223 plate appearances, he's hitting .211, .302, .340. It's a 76 OPS plus. He has been a good defender, but there's literally no reason whatsoever to game his service time, or to worry about his free agency date, or to worry about his arbitration earnings. And I know he was a decent prospect at one point, and maybe he, you know, performs better than he has so far in his rookie season. But good Lord Almighty, if you're worried about his service time, why are you even, you know, who service time aren't you worried about at that point? Yeah, I don't know. It just makes no sense. This team is not going to make the postseason. They made some solid moves of a deadline, but the Beckham trade just has escaped me. The reason for the Beckham trade has escaped me since it was made. And, you know, good for Tim Beckham. It seems like he went to a better situation. He has a manager who seems to trust in him more. He seems like he's going to get a better opportunity to play. And, you know, to his credit, he's making the most of it. And it's kind of funny that the Orioles are actually ahead of the Rays in the standings at this point, given how they approached the deadline and how the Orioles caught so much heat for making the moves they did, whereas the Rays, you know, I think they're mostly applauded because, you know, they made some good moves, but
right.
This one just, ugh. And, you know, I don't know, good for Tim Beckham. That's, I guess, all I have to say on that. Good for Tim Beckham above all.
Yeah, I believe I heard a quote from him saying that he can finally kind of get out of his own head now that he's no longer in Tampa and just play baseball. And boy, that sure seems overdue for a guy who was, you know, so roundly derided as the number one overall pick and, you know, not living up to expectations. And then, you know, immediately he goes to Baltimore and he's playing like a guy who should have been picked 1-1 and, you know, being an electric player and making contact on everything. I mean, Beckham's obviously going to regress, right? I mean, it's not like he's going to get like this forever. He's hitting .400 or something like that since he's come over to the Orioles, and the power might be real, but
you know how he is. He's a streaky dude. He's not going to walk a lot, so it's a lot of grip it and rip it, which fits in well there. I mean, we talked about Trey Mancini earlier. He's a similar style hitter. So, you know, they have a thing for that type, and to their credit, it's worked for them a couple times over the years. And yeah, and remember when we had that episode, and I want to say it was like our third, fourth episode, and we asked the question, would you rather have Tim Beckham or Jurickson Profar? And I believe we both took Beckham. At this point, that looks genius, you know?
Yeah,
we should pat ourselves on the back for that one.
I would definitely like to pat myself on the back for that. It's probably, you know, every four things that I say on this podcast, probably one is right. So you got to hang on to those one right ones that you have every once in a while.
Oh, man, my rate's worse than one out of four.
But yeah, it's been fun to watch that. I just I'm with you on the Espinosa thing. Like, if you're going to run somebody out there this season, why Espinosa? Give Robertson or give Adames some big league reps, because you know they're going to need them. They're going to need them at some point, and Espinosa's not going to help you win, and he's just going to hold a spot.
Yeah, and from one former highly touted prospect making good to a different former highly touted prospect trying to make good. Earlier this week, the White Sox brought up Lucas Giolito. He has since made two starts in 13 innings. He's given up 9 hits, 4 runs, and 3 home runs and walks. He's also struck out 8 and hit 2 batters. What are you thinking so far, Mr. Giolito?
Well, he looked a lot, maybe not a lot, but he looked substantially better in his last outing. You know, he got some strikeouts. He was 7 scoreless, but it wasn't necessarily the easiest 7 scoreless I've ever seen. So I think that he's very different from the pitcher that we may have expected, given his, very few pitchers ever get like an 8 scouting rating, or, you know, 2 8 pitches. They had his fastball as an 8 at Baseball Prospectus, which is the highest scouting score you can give any sort of pitch. And, you know, he hasn't looked like a guy with an 8 fastball yet, in the major leagues or really even at all this year, but I think it's going to be okay. I think he's got enough raw talent to get by. I think the White Sox are going to give him enough rope, and I'm excited to see him actually have some success, whether it's kind of warranted or not. You know, again, 7 scoreless is fantastic. The underlying numbers weren't quite there, but having some major league success may beget some more confidence, may beget some more success for him. So I'm excited to see him keep pitching. I just I do tend to worry about, you know, whether or not he's trying to pitch through some sort of injury or what the case has really been to make his stuff not play up the same way it was promised.
That makes sense. And I'll just, you know, become the worst version of myself for a second here and note that I like that he's also on a staff of James Shields, who has a history of helping young pitchers find themselves and making adjustments that they need to make in order to become more successful. So maybe Shields will add another one to his list of pitchers who have benefited from him. You know, he's helped David Price, Danny Duffy, Alex Cobb, and the list goes on and on and on and on. So, yeah, we'll see if Shields and Cooper and everyone else up there can help Giolito tap into his once, majestic upside. Like you said, I think he got 3 8s, didn't he?
Oh, my
didn't
gosh. He? I didn't mean, they that give him 3 8s?
I'm pretty sure someone gave him 3 8s. I remember there being conversation about that. And so... That's all I have to say on that one. And
yeah, the other thing I'll point out is you talk about Shields. If Giolito can really, you know, harness a changeup, given how, you know, impressive his fastball can be, like being able to go fastball change with, you know, 2 8s as a fastball and a change, he'll be an ace, no question. So you better pick James's brain while he's up.
I think we should all pick James's brain while we're up. And from picking James's brain to... You know what? I have no pun there. No smooth transition. Let me just get it out there. Greg Bird is back. What do you think about that, Brian?
Well, I mean, the Yankees seem to be benefiting every time they can possibly benefit from something. Bird was the only disappointment for this team, really, it seemed like, this season. I mean, maybe the Dustin Fowler injury, but that would probably be it. But, I mean, since he's come back, he seems like he's actually hitting again. So I'm excited for him to do well, and I'm excited for – it's weird to be excited for the Yankees to have some success, but with all their young players, I kind of am rooting for them at this point. But I mean,
You're what?
I'm kind of rooting for the Yankees. It's weird. It's weird. I'm not rooting for them more than the Red Sox because I live in Rhode Island and I'd be shot if I said something like that. But I don't know. I think that this would kind of firm up the last big hole this team had if he can continue to hit a little bit. So yeah, I'm kind of pumped for this. I hope he continues to recover and shore things up for the Yankees.
Yeah, he's reached base 4 times in his first 5 plate appearances back. Obviously, it's just 5 plate appearances, but that's a pretty good clip. And yeah, hopefully he makes it a little easier for Yankees fans to forget that they didn't go out and get anyone at the deadline to help them at first base. I know they got Todd Frazier, but I mean like a Yonder Alonso type or what have you, even Lucas Duda. So I think that's about all we really have to say about Greg Bird. Let's transition to another 4-letter word. That would be Wood, as in Blake Wood, who was claimed off waivers by the Los Angeles Angels. And they didn't stop there. The Angels also went out and signed an old friend in Fernando Salas. So, we've talked about, or at least I've talked about a few times, how the Angels under Billy Epler have sort of made a pattern out of finding these undervalued or overlooked relief options who can step in and help their bullpen. And I guess I would just pose the question to you, of these two additions, who is more likely to become the next good Angels find?
Oh, I don't think there's any question that it would probably be Wood for me. Salas looks broken. He's probably been worked too hard by Terry Collins and the Mets, and he probably needs some time to rest a little bit and recover. Wood has a pretty decent strikeout rate. He is a perfectly serviceable relief pitcher, but he's got one of those upper nine strikeout rates. He just has a control issue, like, I don't know, 90% of relief pitchers at this point, especially right-handers. So if there's one small tweak that can get him a little additional command or control, he's one step away from being a seventh inning guy or being an eighth inning guy, whereas Salas probably needs a little bit more help to get to that point at this point in his career, because his main issue, in addition to being command, is he started being very homer prone. I like the Wood acquisition. I mean, it's basically free talent for the Angels if they've got a roster spot for him. So this is kind of neat.
Yeah, and I agree with you, although I would say that Wood has been one tweak away from being a seventh or eighth inning reliever for like a decade now. Whereas, Salas has at least had some experience, excuse me, some success in a late inning role. I don't know. I guess I'm curious to see what they do with Wood because it feels like a lot of their relief finds have had to do with spin rate and finding a guy who can throw the rising fastball. And to Wood's credit, he can do that, but he usually pitches off his sinker. Which, that's obviously a different thing than pitching up in the zone. And I guess I'm just curious to see if they make an adjustment with his pitch selection or if they're okay with, him throwing that sinker to give him maybe a little bit of a different look. And yeah, you nailed it when you said that he's got a good strikeout ratio. He's just wild. And I don't know, he kind of fits that quad A relief profile too, or at least what used to be the quad A relief profile where yes, you can miss some bats, but your command is so poor that you're going to run into a lot of barrels and you're going to run into a lot of walks. And as we all know, the easiest way to lose a high leverage relief role is to allow a lot of walks and home runs or a lot of walks and hits. You can kind of give up hits or give up walks. You can't really do both. So,
Just one quick thing I'll throw out here is
hit
in
me.
2016, Salas was considered one of the better relievers on the Mets. Good
Yeah.
for him. But he got a 3-year contract at the end of it. If you want to drop on over to Baseball Prospectus and look at wins above replacement player, in 2016, Fernando Salas had about 0.9 wins, which is very good for seventh inning pitcher. Blake Wood had 1.5 because he had a 3.24 DRA that wasn't quite reflected in
Da-da-da-da.
his ERA. So last year, Blake Wood was better. This year, Fernando Salas has been worse, and Blake Wood has been better. So I'm going to put my money on Wood.
I would agree with that. Just don't knock on wood. Moving
Oh,
on to another,
bad.
yeah, moving on to an even worse note. The Padres have claimed Tim Melville off waivers from the Twins. He may even get a start for them. And, here's the thing. And nothing against Tim Melville, but when I saw that the Twins had brought him to the majors, I was like, wait a second. This is not the same Tim Melville who was an early round pick by the Royals like a decade ago, is it? And it is. He was a fourth round pick of the Royals in 2008. Literally, he made his big league debut last year for the Reds. Somehow, unbeknownst to me, he made one start for the Twins this season, and in 3 1/3 innings, gave up 4 hits, 5 runs, a home run, and 3 walks. You know, he's not yet 28, but I don't know. What do you have to say here, Brian? Because I don't really have much to say about Tim Melville in 2017.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything to say here really about Tim Melville. I think the interesting things to say are about the Padres rotation, where, you know, this is a team where you would be hoping that they would be able to find a way to get some young talent, some reps, and, you know, maybe look at some of their developing starting pitchers at this point in their season. And no, not really. They're picking up guys like Tim Melville, so it's not really working out that way for them. It's just very disappointing for me to see, you know, how bad their rotation has been. Even, you know, we thought that it would be bad to start the season. I would have hoped that maybe some of their younger guys would get some more chances, but instead, guys like Travis Wood and Tim Melville are getting shots on the rotation. And
Yeah.
yet, the Padres are not the worst team in the National League West, which is shocking.
Andy Green should get some Manager of the Year votes, right? Just for not, I mean, you know, I think we all reasonably expected this to be, I don't know if I'd say a 110 loss team, but you know, the potential was there for them to lose, you know, 100 plus games, maybe even more than that. And you know, he deserves some credit for seemingly avoiding a 100 loss season, maybe even avoiding a 95 loss season, right?
I love Andy Green. I think he's a great manager, and definitely I think he deserves some of this credit. Also, he is not, in addition to, you know, getting the most out of his players, he's not afraid to be a little bit creative at times, you know, with the Christian Betancourt issue, with the way he's been using his outfield a little bit, with the way that, you know, he's kind of been managing the talent differently now.
They brought in Brad Hand with a 2-strike count against Joey Votto.
Look at this. This is a guy who's being creative and being, you know, doing some different things, mixing it up. So I definitely think he deserves some down ballot Manager of the Year votes. I mean, Manager of the Year usually just goes to whatever team surprises you and is in the playoffs. So I don't know. I guess who gets it this year? Is it Bud Black in the National
Yeah,
League?
I
But
think it's Bud Black or Lavello,
yeah, both of those would be good.
or Dave Roberts, because you know you have a historic performance like that. There's precedent with you know the 2001 Mariners. Lou Piniella won Manager of the Year that season, so I could see it going to one of those three. I think it's going to stay out west, but yeah, I would definitely like to see Andy Green get at least a vote. And you know what? Now that you mention it, is he most likely to become the new Joe Maddon? Where in like 5 to 10 years, we're talking about how Andy Green is so zany and you know, he's so creative and whatnot because, you know, there are some similarities there, right? In terms
Yeah.
of taking over an awful team and sort of trying and experimenting with these wild things that maybe in 2 or 3 years, if the Padres become competitive, all of a sudden are keys to their success rather than just a reason to watch this otherwise an uninspiring group of ball players.
I definitely am with you, and I'm not at all biased by the fact that Andy Green definitely at least heard about one of my articles this offseason at Baseball Prospectus and mentioned it in an interview. So that should color
Wow.
any discussion that you might have about why I'm so into Andy Green as a manager, I think.
Are we now trading, you know, hotshot NL young NL manager stories? Because I have been told that Craig Counsell knows that I noticed the Brewers pitching, excuse me, a Brewers pitcher was tipping his pitches. So,
Oh, nice. Excellent.
yeah, buddy, we are big shots here dropping these names.
We are getting those former utility infielder turned manager page views like you would not
Craig,
believe.
man, hey, Craig Counsell, if you're listening, man, I got you, and we got you too, Andy Green. We got you. Anyway,
right.
while staying on the Padres for just a moment, I want to highlight Carter Capps because we talked about him somewhat
Oh, no.
recently. Yeah, he's made 8 appearances. He is here. Let me just throw this: how many strikeouts do you think Carter Capps has in eight
Well,
appearances?
again, I've been following him a little bit and following his lack of excellence. So I'm gonna go with in 8 appearances now. Maybe he's got like three, four.
Nope. He has one.
One, it is still at one. I was hoping he'd at least have gotten one more.
Let me read Carter Capps' rates before I transition to our next move. 12.9 hits per nine, 2.3 home runs per nine, 2.3 walks per nine, 1.2 strikeouts per nine.
Jeez.
Come on, Carter.
I
You've already.
mean, no, there's nothing good about that. I hate to see a guy pitch so poorly and kind of be hung out there. Hopefully he figures it out.
Yeah. Anyway, speaking of guys who you hope figure it out, the Jonathan Lucroy to the Colorado Rockies trade was finalized this week as the Rangers acquired Pedro Gonzalez from the Rockies to complete that deal. Gonzalez was a former big bonus baby, hasn't really put it together so far in his big league career. Excuse me, big league career. So far in his professional career, if he
Yeah,
was in the
those
big leagues, that would be a lot more impressive because
yeah,
he's.
big rookie leagues maybe.
Right. He doesn't turn 20 until October. I don't know, Brian. What do you have on this guy?
Oh, I got nothing. I'm not a prospect
Yeah.
guy. You know, I've said that before. You know, anytime you can get a guy who's got some of that bonus baby pedigree, it's probably better than getting a guy who's a complete unknown, but
It's a lottery ticket.
he's 2 years away from being 2 years away, and we have no idea what he's going to become. And he's still probably, you know, worth it in something like a Jonathan Lucroy trade, even though Lucroy hasn't been like, you know, any great shakes for the Rockies yet. You know, what do you say about it other than, you know, he's a flyer and maybe he'll work out.
I was just going to say, we'll see. Maybe in 5 years, this looks like the worst trade ever for the Rockies. And maybe in 5 years, we don't even remember who Pedro Gonzalez is. I will, however, disagree with you with regards to Lucroy's value to the Rockies. They had no production whatsoever from behind the plate. And in 19 games of them, he has a 94 OPS plus, which doesn't seem special. But again, they hadn't gotten anything from behind the plate offensively. So I don't know what his framing numbers look like for the Rockies. It's possible he's given all that offensive production back, which is a really weird thing to say about Jonathan Lucroy.
It's very weird.
But I actually think that trade has done exactly what they wanted it to do for them so far, in terms of giving them more offensive production at the catcher's position.
The thing for me is that Tony Walters was kind of my dude, like coming into this season, because he was such a good framer, and you know, he was a fun type of player, having recently converted from
Fun
middle infield.
story.
Yeah.
Yep.
And like Jonathan Lucroy, his framing this year has been awful. Like, what is it with these guys who go from being, you know, kind of more of top-tier framers to really having some issues? I know Walters has been injured too. He's had some concussion issues, but you know, he can't, like Lucroy, if even just sitting at an average level, he can't be that much of a downgrade over. He has to be an upgrade over Walters because Walters was never the kind of hitter that Lucroy was, and his framing was probably just as bad as Lucroy's, if not worse.
Yeah, and they even had Ryan Hannigan up for a little while, and he's sort of the same story. Good framer, or was a good framer. I don't know if his numbers were down and not much of a hitter. And you're right. There is like a league-wide trend where it seems like all the formerly good to great framers are going through decline. You can throw Yadier Molina in that mix. But we cannot mention the Colorado Rockies without mentioning a very important person to this podcast. That's John Gray, the ghost hunter. And I would just note, John Gray's having a pretty good season again. A 120 ERA plus, three strikeouts per walk. Obviously, he missed some time of injury, but yeah, John Gray, man, he's out here just leaving ectoplasm all over the place. So.
That sounds a little gross, but yeah, it turns out that you know if you use DRA, he's having just as good of a season as he did last year, which is that's pretty awesome. I'm really excited for him and. You know, God forbid the Colorado Rockies really developed a consistently good starting pitcher.
Not
It's just.
just one, not just one, because Kyle Freeland has been good.
Yeah, I'll just hold off on Kyle Freeland until he can do it
Fair.
in two different seasons. But yes, you're right. He has been good. They've had a lot of good pitching performances this season, and Freeland's probably been the best.
German Marquise, he's been solidish, and yeah. So John Gray, come on, ghost with me, man.
He's gonna. We're gonna make it happen. We're gonna find a way to do this. We're gonna get in touch with CBS Sports. We're gonna get in touch with Gray's publicist and agent, and we're gonna get the two of you into a hotel in Oklahoma City, and you're gonna look for some ghosts.
Let me tell you, man, I was so disappointed on Sunday because I'm working on two pieces, or I was working on two pieces, and one of them is about catchers and concussions. So thank you for the Tony Walters transition there. Another one was going to be on Barry Zito as a songwriter. And I was going to reach out to some of these other songwriters and to Zito himself and like do all this about, his post-playing career. And then someone retweeted into my feed that NPR had done a piece on him literally Sunday.
Oh
And I was just
no.
like, really? So, you know what? forget Barry Zeo and his songwriting, even though I would recommend checking him out because he's way better than you would anticipate. But you know what? John Gray and Ghost Hunting, that's the new, you know, that's Wired, whereas Barry Zito and songwriting are tired. So
I just find it incredibly unlikely that somebody's going to retweet into your Twitter timeline that, like, oh, we wrote an article about John Gray hunting ghosts. Like, I think you've got the lead on
Michael,
that one.
Michael Clare might. Shout out to Michael Clare. He is, no, he's great. But, yeah, he's probably the one who's going to, like, scoop me on that one. I'll be like, man, come on. What are the odds?
Oh, that's so funny.
On that note, I think it's the appropriate time to give up the ghost on this episode, Brian. So thank you.
For a shot. I was just going to say real quickly, like your Barry Zito piece, I'm disappointed that that might have gotten killed, but was it just an excuse to talk to Ty Kelly about his songwriting career?
Absolutely not. It was an excuse to talk to songwriters about their I'm trying to give, you know, crossover ability, Brian. I got to keep up with the Lindberghs and the Millers.
Oh, no. The good luck with that, RJ. That is some tough shoes to fill, but if anybody can do it, I bet you can.
I bet not. And on that note, I am RJ Anderson. You can catch my work at CBS Sports. Find me on Twitter, if you must, at @R_J_Anderson. Be warned, I tweet about ghosts. Brian, you want to tell the good people where they can find you?
Still Baseball Prospectus, and in the upcoming 2018 Baseball Prospectus Annual, which we're starting to do some work on, so that's very exciting. And then beyond that, I'm going to tease a little bit. Hopefully, I've got a new project that's going to be coming out pretty soon about different ways to implement the three different wins above replacement metrics into one larger framework, so you can look forward to that. There's a little tease for that coming up in the next couple of weeks, and I'm very excited about that. So yeah, that's it for me. So thank you very much for listening. You can find more from the podcast at DFA Podcast on Twitter. You can always find us at Baseball Prospectus and at Blog Talk Radio. Thanks for listening, and we will catch you guys next time.